remember him teaching the people one time on the side of the mountain. He was telling them about a wonderful way of life, and he said to these people, if you want to come along with me, if you like this way and want to come along with me, the first thing you have to do is deny yourself. You have to become unselfish. And then he said to them another time, if you would find your life rooted in the church of your house, completely lose yourself in service. My pleasure, ladies and gentlemen, I present to you this morning one that has lost his life to gain, and also that you and I might have a better way. I present
Well, good morning, folks. I think I'll start plumping on this, Douglas. The chairman just got off the notice. A line that I think could keynote this talk. He said, in effect, that AA was a story handed down. And that story handed down is the legacy of each of us. And it is our privilege, the means of living itself, indeed, to transmit that to the next one. The story handed down, our inheritance, our legacy. Now this legacy comes in three parts. And in recent times, you've all been hearing a lot about the third legacy. I make no doubt that to some of you, the third legacy sounds like a hell of a jumble of boards of trustees and magazines and offices and secretaries and trustees and delegates and group representatives and conference members and an awful lot of dolls, so it appears. That's your impression, perhaps, of the third legacy. Now, I purpose in this next hour to see if we can't get this third legacy business down out of the clouds where it really belongs, so that you can see what it is. Maybe you don't know it, but you really know already what it is. Now, let me take a simple but one of the most potent demonstrations of it that has ever been made. I guess the most potent. Twenty years ago, come this fall, my friend Ebby had been released from drinking. He thought of me. He knew the awful shape I was in. And he thought he'd like to tell me his story, to hand down what had been handed me. So he got himself on the subway and marked this. He had to drop a nickel in the turnstile, otherwise he never got to me. And he arrived and he handed down the story. My legacy, which has three parts. He handed down to me an opportunity to recover from one of the most terrible maladies known to man. He handed down to me the opportunity of getting myself and my affairs and my family and my whole life unified in one piece. He gave me an opportunity by which I could be rendered whole. And above all, he gave me the greatest opportunity that anybody living on borrowed time can have. He gave me the opportunity to do for others what he had done for me. So you see that in that original conversation over the kitchen table there in our home in Brooklyn, the three legacies were handed to me. The legacy of recovery, the legacy of wholeness and unity, and the legacy of action or service. Those were the three legacies which I received from my sponsor, Edmund. And I, in turn, have been trying to pass those three legacies along, and you're in peril. Is exactly the same. The legacy of recovery, number one, number two, of wholeness or unity, and number three, of service, which means action, which means function. Now, the third legacy, in reality, takes in a hell of a lot more than a foundation or an office. It takes in our whole concept of action or service. It takes in all the means by which we are able to carry this message. Now, when Abby came to me, all that was needed was goodwill on his part and a 5-cent fare to get where I was and another one to get back where he was going. But if it hadn't been for that 10 cents, he wasn't the reason, was he? But it was all as simple as that. The rest of it was communication between him and me over a kitchen table, handing me these three legacies, which all of us in turn have been passing along, one to the other. Now then, everybody knows about 12 steps. And, of course, that is the great expression of AA in action, AA in service, AA in function. But we have to make the 12 steps possible, just as Abby's nickel in the turnstile made it possible for him to get to me. And as time has passed, and this thing has grown, the problem of communicating with each other, with the drunk and his wife coming in the door, with the millions who don't know at all about it yet, has got to be more complex, maybe a little bit more expensive, if we are to serve well. So that service in AA is just not a matter of talking to the next drunk. It's getting in touch with him, getting in communication with him, providing him with what he has to have to get well. And he doesn't get well just on talk, as we shall presently see. I suppose that one of the very earliest services was in Dr. Bob's parlor. When everybody went out of the kitchen and brewed a pot of coffee and brought it into that early two or three gathered in that living room. That was a service, a small sacrifice that made our meetings better. It helped make 12-step work fine. The house we sat in was a part of the service.
We don't often do this on the curtain, though.
Well, when the meetings got too big for that house in Akron, they moved to a bigger house, and the people that let us have it were non-alcoholics, were providing us with a service, a place to meet. Well, by and by, that got too small, and then we had to move out into a hall. Well, when we moved out into a hall, we couldn't get a free one. We were up against landlords. At that time, you must remember, there was nothing in AA but talk and easy communication one with the other. But we know that we had to meet together to give ourselves the best chance to stay dry and to give the drunk coming in his opportunity to begin the book. So we had to have meetings. Well, meetings meant meeting places. Up to this moment, there wasn't a cent of money concerned in the protest, except what a fellow took out of his own pocket to help the next guy or to get to him. But now there came a brand new element into our affairs. We started to pay rent on meeting halls, and we started to pay that rent as a group. When we dropped money in the hand and started to pay rent. Well, at that point, being drunk, a good many of us started to grumble. Said, well, goddamn landlord should give halls free for such a noble purpose. But the landlords didn't agree. They said, if you want the hall, you can pay up. So we needed the hall as a service. So we paid up. Now, there was another kind of a service performed in those days, and it still is. The folks who started the group not only had to carry the message and talk to the drunks who came along, but it was soon found that we had to make hookups with hospitals. And somebody had to look after that. It was found when AA entered the town that we needed to communicate with the other drunks in town. So the old timers in the group went to the doctor and to the preacher, and finally wrote the newspaper off. And they got a piece put in the paper that AA had got to town. That was more service that made communication possible with the drunk who still didn't know. After a while, a local founder and his friends, being a self-appointed committee to arrange for the public relations and the hall and the hospital and whatever we needed to have in order to function, even that service underwent a change. Meanwhile, the group was growing and growing, and finally there were bigger and better screwballs down in the bottom of the pyramid than there were on the top. And they began to look at us old-timers and say, how the hell long are you going to be running these services? When do we get in here? So if the old-timers were wise, they kind of stepped off to the side, and the wise ones became elder statesmen and solid in the Christ. Those who weren't wise, they'll connive for election, and sometimes they were cast into outer darkness, where they bemoaned their fate and became what we call bleeding deacons. And on top of this pyramid was the top sliced off. There was this circle going round and round very fast and furiously called a rotating pyramid. Well, now the rotating committee members were all doing individual 12-step work, but they were doing things that enabled that group to function in the community. The tie-up with the hospital, the tie-up with the newspaper, the preacher, the doctor, the employer, arranged for the halls. We had to have a guy called the secretary, usually a gal, We had to have somebody who would account for the money, and we damn well made him account through.
In other words, we couldn't pump unless we had services that made 12-step parts possible, communication possible, and protection for the society possible. We had to get our right foot forward in front of the public. We had to get the story straight to the newspaper. We had to have a public meeting and have speakers that could really put it on. All services that enabled us to grow and function. So we have always been the inheritors and the practitioners of the third legacy ever. And if the third legacy hadn't been practiced, except for one drunk to talk to another whenever he happened to run across one, we wouldn't be sitting here at all. This thing would have been an anarchy. No head or tail to it, what a. So we owe what we have to the practice of the 12 steps and to the provisions of those services that make the 12 steps possible. The individual putting the nickel in the turnstile, a coin in the hat, the committee at work, that's the group service. Well, in large cities, there began to be another problem. Group after group born, but as soon the hospital in town would say, my God, is there no head or tail of this thing at all? The blind come down here leading the blind. They tell us how to run the hospital. You can't get this damn thing on the telephone. Isn't there any head or tail to AA in this city? Well, little by little, it was found in big places that we had to have somewhere you could call AA on the telephone. Where a frantic wife or a husband or whatnot could go and find out about this. So we began to have what was called integral bar. And the surrounding groups out of their treasury, which they got from half passes, provided such an offer. And then we came to another terrible problem that was on the floor. We found that you couldn't man those offices entirely with volunteers. They'd come down and they'd paint the paper and they'd be enthusiastic as hell. But who would sit there morning, noon, and night at the end of this telephone? And if they stood. So then Alcoholics Anonymous actually had to hire somebody. And that's where the money began to spend. The money wasn't spiritual at all. Money was damn spiritual when it was coming into our pocketbook. But when it was going out to pay some poor little gal to hang on this telephone and listen to all these wails all day long, it was real bad. It was going to destroy. But we were forced into it. And it was a good thing we were. So the primary, we began to get a little head or tail of this thing. No government, you understand. But we had to have the right hookup with publicity outlets, the world around us. We had to have a place where we could be found. We had to have hookups with hospitals. So that the 12 steps could be performed. So that we could communicate. So that we could carry the message. We found, too, that we liked talk. At first, some communities loved clubs. Others didn't. They wouldn't have a club under any condition. Because the club was played thin. There was the poker, and the little red riding hoods, and their opposite numbers. And most dreadful things went on in each club. And a lot of places wouldn't have. But then we began to wake up to the fact that if people got in trouble in clubs, they were going to be getting into it anywhere, so they might just as well get into trouble at clubs in
and all the law rules of them. And we began to find that these clubs were great adjuncts to some people. Well, they were a kind of service. And at first, they were the function of the group, but that put the group into too damn much business. And finally, they became the function of the people who were interested in having a club. They were separately incorporated and kind of put off on the side. But this clubhouse, and the contributions there, and the people who look at it, are performing a service that helps people get close. Not only get sober, but stay sober. That's the truth. It's a part of the legacy of the church. It's third legacy. There isn't anything so mysterious or hard about all this. Meanwhile, we succeeded in doing these things without creating a professional class. I don't know that today there is a single AA member who is paid exclusively to do 12-step work in the sense that I'm talking to somebody to help him. You can hire a cook in the club to fry hamburgers, well, that makes good 12-step work possible. You can hire a secretary in an office, not to do 12-step work, but to communicate with people, to bring people together, to get people hospitalized, so that good 12-step work is possible. Now then we come to another service. All part of this third legacy. We realized long ago that this movement would have to have some kind of literature. Otherwise, it would run miles off the track. The 69 versions of it would get traveled, would get ridiculed. Indeed, the story of the preparation of our first piece of literature, the book Alcoholics Anonymous, I will tell you in detail tonight. It was an effort to provide a service. So the book Alcoholics Anonymous and all our pamphlet literature, not only from Foundation, but any piece of writing that's done to help AA, whether by an individual, a group, a foundation, or even Maine, is a part of the third legacy. It's a part of our system of communicating what we know to this next nothing, or to the one who don't know it all. Now then, when we first realized in Dr. Bob's living room, one autumn afternoon in 1937, that enough time had elapsed on enough cases to make it plain as can be that a new light had entered our dark world of alcoholism, this same question came up again. Only this time it came up with relation to AA as a whole. Up to this time, sure, we've been hiring these places. Up to this time, sure, we've been dropping money in hand. Up to this time, we've had committees in the group. But how was this message going to be carried to the millions who didn't know without it just getting garbled all the pieces? So we have a meeting. At that time, we thought all this was going to take a lot of money, somebody else's money, preferably, from the non-alcoholic. We thought that we'd have to subsidize a lot of old-timers and plant them around in various places. We thought that we'd probably have to get some financing for a string of drunk tanks or hospitals, which in turn would make more money, which would hire more missionaries. But we knew we'd also have to have a book. Also, when this thing got publicity, someday, the minute it did, and the news got over the country that alcoholics were really good for, there would be any number of eager and frantic people who would say, "But how? But where? To whom shall I turn? Where shall I write? Who can I call?" So it became obvious, way back there in 1937, that certain things would have to be done for AA as a whole. Just as the individual is vision for the next individual, just as group did it for the group in the community, just as the area later began to function, so does AA have to function as a whole and provide services for the benefit not only of us here, but primarily for the benefit of those who haven't got here yet. So in 1938, his friends, who had been very much interested in us, got together and we formed a so-called foundation. Not an incorporated committee, it was really run. New York, Akron, and some people in New York, most of them friends of Mr. Rockefeller. That's the story I'll come up with tonight. How we didn't get money from Mr. Rockefeller. But at any rate, we have a board of trustees. By this time, we have a book. And now, sure enough, the public. The first one was mentioned in a talk here. I guess it was Sam mentioned last night. Alcoholics and God. Liberty Magazine. Instantly, that was published. Inquiries began pouring into Liberty Magazine. I think 800 or 900 of them, just like that, from all over the country.
Where do I find this? Who do I get in touch with? Now, supposing that we hadn't had any foundation, and we hadn't had any literature, and we hadn't had any office, what would those poor, finite people have done? If we kept AA so damn simple, and we hadn't been willing to spend any money, and nobody had been willing to take any service responsibility, maybe some people right in this audience wouldn't be alive. You only need to go a generation or two back to go back to Alcoholics from God and the 800 inquiries that we wrote to and sent pamphlets to way back there in books sometime back in 1939. Well, as I said, Mr. Rockefeller got interested. He didn't give us money, but he gave us a big dinner to tell the world that this was good. And boy, that story got on the United Press wires, the AP wires. It went around the world like life. Mr. Rockefeller and his friends say Alcoholics Anonymous is good. Another terrific flood of inquiries. Where did they come? The Fort Worth, Texas? No. Not any group there.
Would they have gone if we hadn't thought to provide a service so that AA could function as a whole?
Another flood of inquiries come in. We write all those people. And then in 1941 comes the big payoff. The Saturday Post, through Jack Alexander, does a featured piece for us. And thousands of inquiries for us. And our office is absolutely swamped. Now, up to this time, we've been running the office entirely on the proceeds of the sale of the book. A little Ruthie Hart and one typist and me. We three people, all of a sudden, and the board of trustees that met sometime. So three people get 7,000 inputs. Well, at about that time, we said, well, after all, what we're doing here is for the benefit of everybody. And these inquiries come from all over the world, principally North America. So why shouldn't we go out to you people and say, look, are we going to throw these inquiries in the wastebasket because we can't hire the help to answer them all? We did get some volunteers, but you know how they language. They got tired. What are we going to do? Book money won't do it. Everybody's broke. They ain't giving us any money in that foundation. That's still empty. What are we going to get it? So we came to you. And in that time, you consisted of a couple of thousand people and just a few groups. And we said to you, look, will you help us answer these inquiries?
Well, how much would we ask you to send in?
Well, we would like to write out tell his group how much they ought to pay up. We know drunk better than that.
So we said, well, look, if each group now in existence would send us voluntarily the equivalent of a dollar a member a year, would you answer the general? Well, you do. That money plus some book money would do it. So these people began to contribute. And that $1,000 a year got started to maintain that office, which is first, as I say, focused on answering all these inquiries, and then getting in touch with traveling men and salesmen going around the country, giving them lists of the people in these towns that could be visited. Those who couldn't be visited, we set up a correspondence with. And that is how AA began to spread hope. Not because AA was functioning in Akron or New York City or Cleveland.
The problem is somebody had to tend to. One of them was the group trouble. My God, we thought this movement was entirely going to blow up. One group seceding from another, people kicking the founders out, Red Riding Hood, triangles, quadrangles, sometimes they were hexagons. Then we found that a lot of them were mad at us because it was a big racket in New York. Oh my God, this was in the hectic time of our adolescence when the AA tradition began to be written. Well, what did we start to do, a few of us in that little office in New York? We started to say, look, we can't run this, we know. But what we can do is to retail you the experience that they're having another place. With clubs, with committees, with functioning, group problems, public relations problems, all those kind of things, we began to retail the experience of the older group to the group just formed. So we became retailers and transmitters of experience through the mail, through traveling people who called upon us, and then some of us began to get out on the road. So that AA could grow, so that it could function. Well, then we had another hazard problem of public relations. After the post publicity, we were besieged with all kinds of offers. What kind of pieces should be written? What kind of a presentation should be made with AA? So writers began to send in their manuscripts for us to check up so that the message wouldn't get garbled. Then we began to have the type of AA who wanted to take publicity into his own hands. I know we had a fellow down in Florida, wonderful AA guy, but he thought anonymity was horse and buggy, and he started a group down there on the radio. So all of a sudden he says, well, he said, I got a contract from the Gulf Life Insurance Company, and they're going to put me on for 12 radio appearances, and I'm going to tell the world who I am and what Alcoholics Anonymous is. And he sent us up some of his script. Well, he was a good old Bible Belt boy, and he had a good deal of straight religion mixed up with AA, and we knew that the script wouldn't sit very well on the membership. It meant well, but we knew it wouldn't do. Well, there wasn't any law against his getting up in front of a microphone, was there? What could you do about it? So we wrote him and said, well, now at the time the Saturday Post piece was published, a lot of us spent a long time with Jack Alexander trying to get this story straight. And we agreed upon certain things. We begged him not to do this publicly as an AA, because even when back there we began to sense that we'd have a lot of public big shots and this thing would get all garbled pieces again. Every man with his first. So, what we finally did was this. We had to go to him and say, now look, we're afraid that one man public relations job for AA as a whole is going to set a very bad precedent. Not everybody ought to be able to talk for AA as a whole. Besides, I think you're going to get into trouble with your script. And you say, to hell with the trustees and to hell with Bill Wilson, I'm going to do this. Well, we defend your right to say those things. But at the same time, how would the Gulf Life Insurance got it if it got a lot of what the hell mail from all the drunks over the country who didn't like it? And we'll see to it that they get the mail. So we quieted them down. Now, the office has been doing that sort of thing for years and years. Radio, television, literature written on the outside. We don't want any monopoly of those things, but we just like people to check them up with them, so to keep this thing in the groove, so that the public gets the right impression of it, so that we don't create public big shots. A public relations job had to be done. And because a public relations job was done for AA as a whole, the public has a hell of a good impression. In fact, our reputation with the public is much better than our character. And a part of it is due to the fact that AA was functioning as a whole in public relations. And I asked the trustees to write all you folks who were then around and say, what do you want for us? This board of trustees, through its office, to handle public relations. Well, then AA began to get overseas, and over there they talked a different lingo. We still had to communicate. Well, these translations didn't get made all by themselves. Somebody had to look after them. So we're in all these other languages. So now you read a piece of publicity, and you say, gee, that was good. You don't know that our office may have spent all the hours and days on that. You hear that AA is in Japan. You hear AA is in Norway and Denmark and 52 other countries. How do you suppose it got into those languages? And who checked it up to see whether those translations were good or not? Well, that was AA functioning as a whole in the foundational. And so it goes with all of these talks. By and by, we found that we had to have a magazine. Well, a magazine sprung up in New York. They called it Grapevine. I didn't have anything to do with it. It got some local circulation. People liked it. It was an awful good job. It began to get a national circulation. So I wrote you fellas and said, well, this has already got a national circulation. Would you like to hook it up to this board of trustees, the foundation, like the office and the book is hooked up, and make it your magazine, the reflector of our current thought and action, a primary means of communicating one with the other, a means of communicating with the world outside, inspiring the drunk coming in the door? Would you like to have such a magazine? Okay, then the foundation will guarantee its solvency, and we'll hitch it up to the foundation. So you got a magazine. Well, that took a lot of work from a lot of people. Now, meanwhile, I got paid, not for doing any of these public relations jobs, not for organizing publishing companies, not for looking after that office for the last 10, 12 years, 15 years. I got paid a run on the book Alcoholics Anonymous, which I earned for writing a book, not for talking to you about your sobriety. Just like the gal in the office doing all his office work, or under office as a secretary, or the guy frying a hamburger in a club. I did a service job, so to that extent I've been paid. But you've never paid me to do a professional 12-step job, and you never will. And that's how we all got along, though. And your money coming into that foundation kept that office open. And then the book and the literature began to sell better, so that we got a little reserve fund. And this thing went building up and building up. And by and by, we commenced to lose touch with you people. You got to be too many. Nobody knew the board of trustees anymore. And we began to wonder what would become of this center of service. This office, this literature, this magazine, this board of trustees. And suddenly we woke up to the fact that the only link between that center of service that had accounted for half of the size of AA, a large amount of its public repute and growth, the only linkage between that and you people was in the gals in the office who wrote all these letters, Smithy and me. You didn't know these trustees, men. They weren't even responsible to you. They were just an incorporated committee really to try and help Smithy and me out to do this job. Well, we saw that this couldn't go on forever. And when it got evident that poor old Smithy was going to cash in pretty soon, and we had a couple of breakdowns in the office, with people overworked, by the time we had seen that thing run awful deficit, and the groups were responding less and less to our yearly, twice-yearly appeals for money, we thought it had to be some kind of a hookup. Well, finally, at one time, a few years back, the groups were failing to pay the office expenses by $2,000 a month, and the grapevine had got overambitious and had put out a lot more pages than artwork, and they suddenly began to lose $1,000 a month. Where do you think that $3,000 a month came from? It came out of that foundation reserve fund, where slowly we've been accumulating a little money over and above what you folks would send us in and what we needed to run the office. In other words, the old book, Alcoholics Anonymous, and its income to the foundation kept that place alive when contributions weren't keeping it alive. Well, we saw that state of affairs could never go on forever. We also saw that we old timers were just like that original committee in Keokuk. You know, the founders and their friends were providing the services, but at some point, you, now a grown-up movement, would say to us, how long are you people going to run these services? When are they going to be out? Are we ever going to know who the hell you are? Are we going to have the power to throw you out if you don't perform? And if ever this movement gets into serious trouble, political trouble, religious trouble, money exploitation trouble, catching me in bed with a blonde. When we hit that kind of trouble, what are we going to have to say about it, and how are we going to say it? We knew that those things must be in your mind. We knew that that center of service, which really includes the world, could never be safe nor secure unless it became a function of you, and not a function of the old time. Well, sitting in the center of things, this terrible hazard and open end in our affairs was apparent to me as early as 1945 and 6. That happened to be a period in which things were rocking along comfortably. The contributions almost ran the dump down there, and the grapevine wasn't losing much money, and the book money made up the debt. So I go to my friends, the trustees, and I say, listen, the gals in the office and Dr. Bob and I are the only linkage between you people and these services and all of Alcoholics Anonymous all over the world. When we cook or get discredited time some fine morning, there won't be any. And when that time comes, you fellas just pull one boner, and this thing is going to collapse right in the middle. There won't be any way of putting it together. This thing, which has been the lifeblood to tens of thousands of alcoholics, and which will be the lifeblood to hundreds of thousands of building companies. Won't you let me go out and ask the movement if it doesn't want to take this thing over and look at it? Will the movement now look after its own business, this vital business that has to go on? Well, I said, we're getting along all right. Let's keep it simple. That's what all old timers say when there is a stirring in the mass. The mass begins to ask, how long are you going to run this? The old timers say, well, let's keep it simple. No, we don't want any politics around here. Well, I'm coming.
I say he's on the air. Well, it's certainly a public problem. There's supposed to be about 4 million alcoholics in the country. If you know a drinker, you certainly know it's a social problem. In the early days, the doctors used to feel that there was nothing inherited. Certainly you don't inherit a craving for grog. We do notice in AA, though, that certain families have a great many alcoholics. And it has been suggested that very likely they get emotionally bunged up and made neurotic and therefore laid wide open to alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
Not because it is strictly inherited, it's more of an environmental
thing. Of course, you see the parents drinking a lot and the people around the home,
yeah.
And you fall into the habit and you may not have the capacity for evaluation.
Yeah, but you'd think that somebody in a family where one somebody older is an alcoholic, the youngster would see the bad effect of the alcohol and thus stay away from it.
You're exactly right. They often do. They go to an extreme of great hatred of drinking of all sorts on the one side, or later they themselves fall victim.
Mm-hmm.
It usually runs to extremes. They're either reformers or drunks.
Don't you think, Bill, that in the most instance, it's a case of someone having a great disappointment or a circumstance that forces them into this?
Well, in my own case, there was childhood inferiority. I was a bit gawky.
Mm-hmm.
Kids could push me around in quarrels. And that developed a tremendous power drive to be a number one champ. You see, I had to be leader of everything. And then when frustrated, I would become depressed. And that pattern in me developed before there was any alcoholism. Well, then I found that on my first drink, indeed, during World War I, that it cured the social inferiority. People drew near to me, I drew near to them. It was a solvent.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't just a mere relaxation. I had begun to try to cure what you might say is a neurotic pattern. And that is the case with a great many alcoholics, but generalization is dangerous. Some alcoholics are simple addicts, and there are a great many types. And as I say, this is for the doctors rather than for AAs. I can only speculate a little on my own case.
Now, my understanding is that when you go to a party, for instance, you can never have just one drink, you yourself, or alcoholics generally.
No, no more than a diabetic can have one spoon of sugar. And probably he's a lot more sane about sugar than we are about alcohol, because we not only have the physical sensitivity, there is this terrible obsession or drive to drink, which has to be released. And if you take one drink, it triggers the whole business again.
You know, Bill, it's a funny thing how you acquire a pattern. Now, I had a similar experience as a youngster, but I saw someone, a very beautiful woman, get drunk when I was a child. And you know, I have never had a drink. And my problem was going to parties and with people who do drink, and I have my own little beverage called water on the rocks, which I take. But perhaps my resentment is, as you say, as radical as the person who overdrinks.
Now, just a second, Virginia. What do you mean you've never had a drink? We have a champagne party right here in this
Listen to this.
Studio.
I'm nailed to the clock for my friend. I had one thimbleful of champagne and
absolutely... she was flying, may I say.
Flying out to get rid of it.
How, Bill, can you get a person to face up to the fact that he is an alcoholic?
In the early days of AA, they only faced up because they laid on their backs and couldn't move. And it was do or die. In that period, we dealt with last gasp cases only. But in recent years, more and more people are recognizing that they have this symptom, this compulsion to drink when they shouldn't be drinking, this terrible hangover business. And it's just as though you went to your doctor came to you and said, I don't like the looks of this sore. He takes a culture. And he says, well, it's very small, but it's very malignant. It's cancer. You see?
Sure.
So, likewise, a lot of people are recognizing these symptoms, and they're coming in much earlier. We're getting a lot of young people. We're getting a lot of people not in any great trouble.
Yes. What is an alcoholic? Well, how do you know if you are an alcoholic?
Well, I would say that the easiest definition hangs around the word control. If when you should control your drinking, and you wish to control it, and you still do not, that is one of the great warning symptoms. It is this compulsive desire to drink against your will and against your interest. If I go to a Legion convention where everybody was supposed to get tight, and I get tight, it's meaningless. On the other hand, if I got a business appointment and I don't need it because I'm tired, or I come in there and ball it up, I may be still a long way from the poorhouse. I may not have been in the hospital yet. The family may still be together. But that's the telltale thing. This lack of control when there should be control, when you're trying to control and it won't.
When one drink is too much and 14 isn't enough,
that's about the story.
Now, what in the area of activities with AA, how many cures would you say have been affected, Bill?
Well, I'll correct you. There are recoveries, but
true.
We
it's
think that we have 150,000 easily. The movement is spread now into 70 countries and U.S. possessions. It goes on pyramiding. We're in a tremendous period of growth just now, one alcoholic carrying a message to another.
Of course, you're not an organization in the full sense of the word, and how does a family reach you? Let's say that somebody wants to discuss a problem with a member of their family who, by the way, is not receptive to AA. Now, this to me is the big problem of getting the offender to a meeting because they have to come voluntarily, don't they?
Well, nowadays, doctors and clergymen both are very, very helpful in laying the groundwork for AA.
Mm-hmm.
They can raise the bottom and hit the chap with it. And most always, it's best to try the doctor first. If the doctor will say, look, you have the symptoms of this thing.
Mm-hmm.
We're not going to force you into AA. We know that that's no way, but why don't you go and inform yourself more about this? Go to an AA meeting. Sometimes literature falls into their hands, or it can be left around. But you cannot force people, as a general thing, into AA. They have to be attracted to it somehow, and they have to go strictly in their own interest.
Mm-hmm. Your plan is a 24-hour plan, as I understand it. I shouldn't say the entire plan is, but would you explain the 24-hour plan?
Well, that's one of our cliches, which is becoming notable. It simply means that emotionally, we do not live in the past or in the future. We try to live for today.
Get through the next 24 hours.
Let's go through the next 24 hours without a drink, and that is the springboard that most people take off from at the very beginning until they have a basic fundamental relief so that the problem becomes non-existent.
Mm-hmm.
They go on this 24-hour basis. And the intimation is that we mustn't morbidly dwell on the past or daydream about the future.
Right.
Let's live one day at a time.
I wonder if you would be kind enough to repeat for us the serenity prayer used by AA, Bill.
God grant us the serenity to accept the things we cannot change, courage to change the things we can, and wisdom to know the difference.
Isn't that wonderful?
Sure is, not just for AA. God grant us the serenity to accept the things we cannot change, courage to change the things that we can, and the wisdom to know the difference.
I think the description of the prayer, as Bill said before, is that it's like a tent that encompasses and covers all of us.
Thank you so much, Bill, for being with us this
morning. Again, our great thanks to you people.
And God bless you in your work.
Tomorrow we start a new guest book series on higher education in America. Our guest at that time is going to be Dr. Eugene Austin, who's the president of Colby Junior College up in New London, New Hampshire.
Quick, Richard Hudnut's new quick.
For the benefit of the March at Arms, Thursday, April 12th at the Roxy, a good picture for adults, the man in the gray flannel suit. And now our second program in the series, They Help One Another. And no formal introductions today, that is no last names. I agreed to abide by the rules of Alcoholics Anonymous. But Bill, co-founder of AA, is here, and so is Eve, a member. I find it not too difficult to sit here and call them by their first names as they ask me to do, because they both seem to be busily trying to be sure that I'm comfortable about the whole thing. Good morning, Bill.
Good morning to you. Thanks very much for having us on the air with you.
And I'm glad you're here too, Eve.
Well, I'm enjoying it very much.
Bill, do you want to just start right out by telling us how and when you founded AA?
Yes. If you don't mind, I'll start a little bit in the middle.
All right.
In the summer of 1934, I lay in a drying out hospital on Central Park West, Charles B. Towns Hospital. My wife was downstairs talking to the doctor. I had been there before. It was the end of a long road. And she was asking the doctor why I couldn't stop drinking. And the good man was obliged to tell her that I had an obsession of the mind that condemned me to drink against my will, a sensitivity of the body, which he called an allergy, so that if the drinking was continued, I would be destined to go mad or to die. In fact, he told her frankly that she would soon have to lock me up if my life was to be saved. It was the end of the road, and I knew it. I was a hopeless alcoholic, and in those days, the chance of recovery was rated at 1%, 2%, or 3%. I'd been raised in a small country town, had gone to the World War, had been beset with a lot of inferiorities and a corresponding power drive. Returning here, I got into Wall Street, made money much too fast for one so young. I suppose in those days I drank in order to feel more grandiose and to cover up these inferiorities. After the crash, when all was swept away, I tried to start again and, of course, could not. I was thoroughly discredited, and therefore I began to drink for oblivion. And that finally, by progressive stages, brought me to the pass I just described in the hospital. Meanwhile, my wife stuck, as the wife of many an alcoholic does. We were otherwise happily married. No one could understand the thing. It was really a deep mystery at that time, the true nature of this malady. Meanwhile, other forces were gathering themselves to create the Society of Alcoholics Anonymous. Perhaps in the early 30s, a certain American businessman was being told by Carl Jung in his office at Zurich after a year's treatment, which was a failure, that nothing could be done for him, that his only possible chance of recovery was through a spiritual experience. And our friend said, "But I'm a good Episcopalian." The great and humble Jung said, "No, that isn't enough. I mean a transforming spiritual experience that will eject this obsession to drink that you have. I can do nothing for you." This friend finally found such an experience in the Oxford groups of that time, a society to which AA owes very much, although some of their tenets we have since discarded. In his turn, he brought some basic ideas to a friend of mine, a schoolmate, who was also in a very bad way, about to be committed for alcoholic insanity. And in turn, this friend, who I shall call Abby, came to me in November of 1934, following this sentence of the summer, and he appeared at my house on Clinton Street, Brooklyn. I was home drinking. Lois was working then in the department store supporting me. And I was very much open to any way to get out of this thing. He appeared in the door, and I remember how he looked. I can remember it now, even through the haze of gin, which I constantly was. I realized that something had happened to him. He sat down at the kitchen table. I offered him a drink. He said, "No, no, thanks." And I said, "Eddie, what's got into you?" And smilingly, he looked at me and said, "I've got religion." Well, I was raised in one of these modern schools that teaches that man is God. This was very disappointing. I asked him what brand he'd got. It soon fell out he'd been in touch with the Oxford groups. And again, he disclaimed some of their teachings, but said that others had made all the difference. And these, in brief, are what they were. He had been advised to get honest with himself, as he had never been before. He was advised to make the an inventory of his defects, confide these to another in confidence. He was advised to make restitution to the people that he had harmed. In other words, a sort of internal and external house cleaning or catharsis, if you please. And then he was advised to go and try to be helpful to others without any demand for reward, the kind of giving that has no price tag on it. And hence he had come to me. Well, this all sounded good so far, and I said, well, where does the religion business come in? Well, he said, I had to take that very easily. He said, I had to pray to whatever God there might be. But curiously enough, as soon as I became willing to admit that I was helpless, became willing to follow these simple precepts, which indeed might have been found elsewhere than in the Oxford groups, I was unaccountably released from my drinking, as my friend Roland had been before me. Also, the impact of Dr. Jung, this man of science, saying that he couldn't do anything about Roland's condition, had made a deep impression on me. So there I was, opposite my friend, looking at him over the kitchen table. And then and there, in all probability, the spark that was to be Alcoholics Anonymous was struck. Shortly afterward, I went back to the hospital. The doctor took me off liquor. My friend visited me there. At first, I was suspicious. I was afraid I was going to be evangelized. Again, I asked him what his simple little formula was. Again, he repeated it. Get honest with yourself. Confess your faults. Make amends to those you've harmed. Try to help other people without any thought of reward. Pray to whatever God you think there is, if only as an experiment. It was just as simple, yet just as mysterious as that. When he had gone, I fell into a terrific depression. And in the bottom of that depression, I cried out, even as a small child might, if there is a God, will he show himself? Instantly, the place lit up electric white. It seemed to me that I stood on the top of a mountain. The great wind was blowing, which I realized was not of air, but of spirit. When the ecstasy subsided, I lay on the bed. It seemed to me that I was now in a new world where everything was all right. A great peace settled over me. Well, then my scientific education got busy, and I said, hey, Bill, you're hallucinating. You better get the doctor down here. So in came my doctor, who will be known someday as a medical saint. Dr. William D. Silkworth. Many a physician might have said, well, my boy, you're hallucinating. You'd better take something. He questioned me very carefully. And at length he said, Bill, something has happened to you. There has been some profound psychic upheaval here. I have read about these things in the books. Whatever it is that you had better hang on to it. It's better than what had you an hour ago. So instantaneously, I was released from this terrific obsession to drink, which would have presently landed me in an asylum, and haven't been seriously tempted to this day. Immediately, I began to speculate on why this had all happened. I wondered why other alcoholics couldn't have experiences like this, these transforming experiences. Curiously enough, at that time, somebody brought me a copy of William James on Varieties of Religious Experience. William James, as you may know, is considered one of the fathers of modern psychology. And here was the account of many such an experience as mine. Not all of this brilliance, not all with this speed, but the essence of them all was that they started with calamity. And they ended in a transforming experience that enabled the individual to do that which he just couldn't do on his own motive power. At once you began to wonder, well, what alcoholics really need is more deflation. Perhaps one alcoholic talking to another over this bridge of common understanding, across this kinship of a common suffering. Maybe that's how it happened to me. My friend Ebby was an alcoholic. The man who had talked to him, who had been pronounced hopeless by Carl Jung, was one alcoholic talking to another. So I began frantically working with alcoholics. Briefly, I joined the Oxford groups, but those good people were more interested in saving the world than alcoholics, and they'd had rather bad luck with us. And the work kept on. We filled our house in Brooklyn with them, but nothing happened for 6 months. We had no success whatever. About that time, it was thought I'd better get back into business. I went to Akron, Ohio on a business deal. It fell through. I was left with not enough carfare home in the Mayflower Hotel there. And then I had one of the few temptations to drink. And suddenly I remembered how much it had meant to me to help another alcoholic. Even those I had tried to help who hadn't made any recovery had nevertheless helped me. So I got off my high horse of preaching and of talking so much about this strange experience of mine, and remembered the advice of Dr. Silkworth, who said to me, "Bill, you can soften these people up if you will pour it into them how hopeless this really is, an obsession of the mind that condemns one to drink, and an allergy that condemns one to go mad or die. Why don't you throw that dose into them first, and then maybe they will buy this moral psychology of yours?" So I remembered that. I called up a preacher in town, saw his name on a directory in the lobby of the hotel. He referred me to some Oxford groupers who I thought might be in touch with some alcoholics, but none would see me except one at the very end. And she came with a noted family there in town. She was not an alcoholic, but she said, "You come right out here." And when I arrived, told her the story, she said, "I know just a man. He's a doctor in this town. Used to be a noted one. His house is about to be foreclosed. His wife is a semi-invalid. He's tried everything. He just can't make it stick." Next day, this doctor, who all A's know as Dr. Bob, now dead since 1950, and my partner in this thing, appeared at my friend Henrietta's house with his wife, Ann. And I remembered what Dr. Silkworth had said. And although my friend Dr. Bob was a physician and surgeon, he knew really nothing about alcoholism. And when I told him the nature of this disease, after identifying with him by reciting my own experience and symptoms, apparently that struck him deep. And he was shortly released from his drinking, never to take a drink until 1950. I went to live with that family briefly to pursue this vain business venture. And his doctor said,